under market purchasing. Purchasing a property under market value is a definite manufactured growth strategy because immediately on purchase, the property is worth more and you now have a built-in amount of equity in the deal. There are numerous reasons why a property may be sold under market value, and understanding these can assist you in locating a property of this nature. Non-local real estate agent. When a property is being marketed by a real estate agent that is not local to the area, there is the possibility that they do not fully understand the market, or the market may be moving quickly in price and they are not keeping up to speed with it. Being aware of this and targeting properties being sold by agents remote to the area is a definite strategy. Incorrectly advertised. There are instances where a property is incorrectly advertised and even the real estate agent has not picked it up. For example, it may be advertised with fewer bedrooms or bathrooms than actually exist, or it may be listed as a smaller land size than it really is. Maybe there are additional land titles not listed, or there may be additional features just not acknowledged, like a granny flat on site. Even sometimes the address can be wrong. Clearly, all of these have the potential to increase the value of the property, and so you need to check this detail and compare the advertising with what is actually on site when you inspect. You should even do your own research to double check the land size and titles, etc. Development potential not acknowledged. Properties do come on the market that have development potential, but are not being promoted as such. And in fact, the owner and real estate agent may be completely unaware of the potential. In this instance, understanding the town planning scheme and the characteristics we have discussed earlier in this module become paramount to capitalise on these opportunities. Maybe the agent doesn't realise the property's zoning and its potential, or may not know that the land size will allow it to be further developed and subdivided. Maybe it has been advertised as a smaller land size than it really is, and in reality, it can be further developed. Maybe the agent hasn't recognised that firewalls exist between the units, therefore making it a potentially straightforward strata title deal. Maybe the town plan has recently changed and the agent just isn't up to speed with the changes and the implications. Alternatively, you may know of zoning changes that are imminent and may favourably impact on this property. Motivated seller. The most common reason why a property may be sold under market value is because the seller is motivated and just wants the property sold and the price reflects that. This may be because of divorce, or because the property is part of a deceased estate and the benefactors want their money sooner rather than later. Or alternatively, it may just be a problem property for the owner. Maybe they have had tenant problems and are just wanting the problem and therefore the property gone. Or maybe there are maintenance issues or termite damage. The list goes on and on. Mortgagee sales or bankruptcy sales are other examples. Often these terms will be listed in the advertising of the property, and this is an opportunity for you to spot potential deals. Terms to look for include desperate seller, motivated seller, under market value, termite damage, deceased estate, divorce, make an offer, mortgagee sale, bankrupt, just to list a few. The program Investar is brilliant for searching based on these terms and has a keyword search filter that allows you to select these items in the search for properties. House relocation. The strategy of relocating a house and moving it from one site to another has the potential to create an increase in the value of the completed property. The success of this strategy and its profitability is hugely influenced by the characteristics of the house being relocated and the characteristics of the destination site, and so an understanding of these is essential. Before covering these aspects, though, let's touch on the various sources of houses to relocate, because this too affects the process. Houses may either be sourced specifically for the purpose of relocation and purchased from a house removal specialist company, or they may be an artifact of another deal. In this first instance, the relocatable house is being sold by a removal company, and the houses have generally been selected based on their properties for relocation. For example, minimum asbestos, or asbestos has already been removed, house is not heritage protected, house is of a size and design that is able to be moved economically, etc. The alternative is where the house is part of another deal you are doing or is being sourced directly from the owner. In this instance, all of the property and location characteristics detailed below are relevant, as a house removal company hasn't already done some of the work for you. Either way, understanding these characteristics is essential. Characteristics of the house being relocated, demolition control, heritage. When assessing the suitability of a house for relocation, it is essential to ensure that it is not in a demolition control precinct or a heritage control precinct, or in fact that the house itself is not heritage listed. Each council may have a different definition for what qualifies as demolition control or heritage, and often it will relate to the age of the property. Some councils will have actually identified individual houses, whereas others will work more on a street and suburb basis. In some instances, you may be able to negotiate with council regarding the particular house, especially if you can prove that it in fact does not have heritage significance, or is not a good example of a house of that era, maybe because of the alterations already done on the property in the past. Some councils may also restrict the distance the house can be moved and may allow it to be relocated, but state that it must stay in the same suburb or in the same council zoning. A council town planner or consultant town planner will be able to advise on these requirements. Construction of the house. For a house to be able to be relocated, it needs to have been built off the ground and be elevated either by posts or piers or the like. There needs to be room to be able to access the underfloor area, even if it is only 300 mil gap. This is sufficient for a house removalist to access and be able to raise the house up further for them to install the necessary machinery underneath. A house that has been built directly on the ground on a slab is not suitable for relocation, or at least is not an economical relocation process. Of course, if you throw enough money at something, anything is possible, but that certainly doesn't make it viable, and we are only interested in profitable deals. So definitely avoid slab-on-ground homes for relocation. Even if you haven't visited the house yet, photographs will reveal the build style. The second factor is the flooring material. Avoid an elevated home with a suspended slab flooring. Not that this would be very common, but it's worth mentioning just in case. The preference is a timber-based floor as it can tolerate movement to some extent. Size of the house, single or double shift. The size of the house is very important when considering relocating it, as it dictates whether the house can be moved in one piece, otherwise referred to as a single shift, or whether it needs to be cut and relocated in two or more pieces, called a double shift. It is typically the width of the house that will dictate whether it is a single or a double shift, because there is a maximum width that can be transported on the back of a truck, even with police escort. If the house is wider than this width, it will typically need to be cut in half to ensure it complies with the police and transport department's regulations. Because these regulations can change between states, it's best to do your research up front and call a couple of house removalists in your general area to find this out, prior to inspecting a potential house for relocation. Clearly, a house that needs to be cut in half will be twice the amount of work for the house removalist, and this is reflected in the cost to do the job. Also, the renovation work required post-relocation will be substantially more, as the floor, wall, and ceiling joins need to be attended to, and generally the services have been cut and need to be reconnected. The services will be covered in more detail, though, in a separate section below. It is also worth remembering that while a house may be of a size to comply with a single shift and therefore be a cheaper alternative in the move phase, this will mean that you end up with a smaller sized house at the other end. This needs to be considered in terms of the target market for the completed product, and you need to factor in whether you in fact need to do an extension to the house or raise it up higher and build in underneath, both of which options will substantially add to the cost. These are definitely not essential, but just something you need to be mindful of, as it significantly affects the cost of the project. Age of house and services. The age of the house will affect whether it complies with the current building code or whether works will be required to bring it up to code. For example, it is not uncommon for older Queenslander-style houses to have been built without the roof being tied to the walls and without the walls being tied to the floors. Once the house is relocated, though, these connections need to be achieved and works need to be undertaken to ensure this. The house will also need to comply with the current energy efficiency requirements, which will affect the lighting, plumbing, and insulation, to name a few, and you may even need to bring the glazing up to code. A building certifier is the likely person that will need to inspect these works, and so it is worth phoning a couple in advance to determine the requirements you will need to meet. The age of the electrical and plumbing services is also very important, keeping in mind that these services may have been upgraded in the recent past. They are important because they need to be cut when disconnecting the house from the mains lines, and also if the house is a double shift, they will get cut when separating the house. If these services are old, particularly the wiring, an electrician cannot legally reconnect the wiring and you may be up for a complete rewire of the house. Similarly with plumbing. If the piping is very old, you may be faced with a complete replumb of the house, all of which come at a cost to the project. An inspection by a licensed electrician and plumber will confirm these details for you. Asbestos. The presence of asbestos is a major factor that needs to be determined, as it can be a significant cost to the project, but also in some councils it may even affect if a house can be relocated into that shire. This is because some councils will not allow a house with asbestos to be transported into the shire. Asbestos can be found in the roofing material, soffit material, bathroom and wall linings, even in the pipework, and should be assessed by a licensed asbestos contractor before it is tampered with. House cost. The cost of a relocatable house can sometimes be a trap for the novice, particularly when the house is being given away for free, or if the house isn't costing you anything because it's an artifact of another deal. While you would think that this was a huge advantage, do not go into the deal for this same reason alone. This is because, even with the house itself not costing you anything, certainly the cost of the relocation process and the renovation and site preparation at the other end can mean that even a free house may not be a profitable deal. There is a lot of misinformation out there about what homes can be relocated and how they are relocated. Much of this is due to the regulations in the United States being far more lenient than in Australia. As an example, the two houses below show the difference between what is acceptable in Australia versus what is acceptable in the US. Characteristics of the destination site and distance from where the house is currently located. The distance the house is to travel to its final destination is clearly a factor that needs to be considered because of its cost implications. In saying that though, most house removal companies will have a flat fee up to 100 kilometres distance. So whether you are taking the house to the end of the street or 100 kilometres away, the price could be very similar because most of the work is in getting the house prepared and onto the back of the truck. If you are planning to travel hundreds of kilometres though, accommodation cost may also be incurred, particularly if the house can only be removed during nighttime hours, which is often the case for larger loads. Land covenants and council's acceptance of relocatable homes in that area. Before securing a site to relocate a house onto, it is essential that there are no covenants on the land that may prevent this. This is particularly relevant to land in newer estates or even older, more prestigious estates. The developers of these land subdivisions commonly put covenants on the land to maintain a certain level of quality in the houses being constructed. It is not uncommon for relocatable homes to be completely prohibited in these areas. A search of the title should disclose any such covenants. Similarly, at the council level, some councils may restrict the style of house that can be moved into an area. For example, in some councils, they are aiming to protect the streetscape appeal of certain areas and will require a particular style of home to be constructed or relocated. Hence, not just anything can be moved in. Understanding this by questioning a council or consultant town planner is essential in your research phase. Access to the destination block. Ensuring that you have sufficient access at the destination site is essential, given that the house will be arriving on the back of a truck and the truck needs clear access to the site. Professional house removalists are very skillful at manoeuvring large loads and can in some instances lift the load or tilt the load to lift over fences, shrubs and the like. However, the more difficult the access, clearly the more expensive the move will be. Remember though, house removalists are not miracle workers and some sites just clearly cannot be accessed. This is particularly the case where you are trying to relocate a house behind an existing house and the site access is very limited. This is certainly a question that has been asked in the past, but unless a house has been specifically built to be craned in and to be picked up from a central crane point, then craning in a house is generally not an option for a standard house, as they have not been designed and engineered to be suspended in the air. A conversation with the house removal companies will guide you on their specific requirements for access. Maximum price variance. A mistake commonly seen with house relocation as a manufactured growth strategy is that because people might get the house for free or relatively cheaply, they default to looking at low-cost land for the destination site. The problem with this is that the cost to move the house and renovate the house is generally set, but what varies is the value of the end product. So if you target cheap, low entry price land, there will generally be a ceiling on the end value, and again it will be at the lower end. Instead, a better alternative is to search for land in areas where there is a large or maximum price variance between the low of the market and the mid of the market. This was discussed in detail in the previous module, but the theory here is that if you are spending $120,000 to relocate and renovate the house, you want to put it on a block of land where the end value is going to be the highest for your dollar spent. So instead of putting it on a $180,000 block of land with a potential end value of $350,000, you would be better off putting it on a block costing $250,000, but with a potential end value of $450,000. Obviously, you need to stick to your budget, but certainly if you could afford a block between $180,000 to $250,000, and the $250,000 option in this example would be the best, because there is a larger price variance between the low and the mid of the market in the area. Also, if your intention is to sell the end product, you want there to be a volume in the market to be able to sell into. Again, this was discussed in Module 2, but choosing cheaper land in a more regional area will not necessarily be the best strategy if you need to sell the end product, because in cheaper regional areas, population is smaller, there are less buyers in the market, and the time frame to sell may be longer, which may impact on the profitability of the deal. Physical land characteristics and location of services. The physical characteristics of the destination land are very influential on the success of the house relocation deal because of their impact on the cost of doing the deal. The type of characteristics referred to are things like land slope, because the steeper the block, the greater likelihood for retaining, stormwater management, longer house posts, etc., which all come at a cost. The soil type and geophysics of the area will affect the type of footings required for the posts and therefore the cost. For example, a site affected by slip could cost you dearly in the footings. Also, the position of services can be very influential, not just regarding the ease to connect into them, but also the ease with which you can negotiate around them. For example, overhead power lines can affect your capacity to access the site, and although this may not be a deal breaker, it will come at a cost to have the lines raised. In contrast, a poorly positioned power pole may turn a profitable deal into an unviable one, because these can be very expensive to move, especially if it has a large transformer attached. The existence of manholes in the access pathway can also be problematic if trucks have to drive over them, because any damage caused will be at your cost to repair. Again, this may not be a deal breaker, but being aware of it is important. Whilst this is a strategy you may not undertake as a first deal or ever, list the characteristics you are looking for in a removal house and a removal house site. Renovation. The process of renovating a property is to do some level of improvement to enhance its condition, its presentability, and its market value. The spin-off is that renovation is also likely to increase the rental rate potential and therefore the income from the property. And hence renovation is both a manufactured growth strategy and an income strategy. There are three major categories of renovation, depending on the extent of works undertaken: cosmetic renovation, structural renovation, extensions. Cosmetic renovation. A cosmetic renovation is one where only the cosmetics or the superficial features of the property are improved. Think of it as the surface finishes, fittings, and fixtures. This includes the paintwork inside and out, the landscaping, the floor coverings, window coverings, doors and door handles, light fittings and fans, and making good general repairs. It includes tidying up, painting, and even replacing the kitchen cupboard fronts to freshen them up, right through to actually replacing the kitchen and the bathroom. With a cosmetic reno, however, the location of the plumbing and electrical generally wants to stay in the same place. This is because once you start moving these services, including the toilet, shower, bath, vanity, kitchen sink, and oven, it can start to become much more expensive. It also requires more specialist trade services for demolishing or accessing parts of the built structure, like the plumbing and the power in the walls and under the floor. Typically, a cosmetic renovation can be completed by yourself, although it doesn't have to be, and a couple of specialist tradies like a plumber and electrician. And generally, no building approval should be required, as you are not adding services like a bathroom, toilet, or shower. As a rule of thumb, a cosmetic renovation should cost you no more than 10% of the purchase price in order to make it a profitable cosmetic renovation. You still need to do a feasibility on each project, though, because if the price variance in your area is low, then even a 10% renovation may be overcapitalizing. This is particularly the case if you plan to sell on completion and you will therefore have purchase and sale costs as well as the renovation costs. Purchase and exit costs can generally be estimated at a total of 6%. This will be covered in more detail below when price variance analysis is discussed. Structural renovation. A structural renovation is where you are staying with the current footprint of the existing dwelling. However, you are removing or adding structural elements of the building. This includes removing or installing walls, replacing or changing the roof line, adding or removing windows and doors, adding or removing wet areas like bathrooms, laundry, or kitchen. Adding a deck would also come under a structural renovation. Because you are altering the structural integrity of the building, for example, removing structural walls that are currently holding the roof up, building approval will be required. Plans will also need to be drawn up. A builder or engineer will be required to approve and inspect the works, as will a building certifier. The approval process differs between states and councils, as does the terminology used, and so you will need to research what is required in your chosen area. As a general rule of thumb, a structural renovation should cost you around 25 to 30% of the purchase price. Again, this is not a hard and fast rule, but a general guide, and for the same reasons as I explained above for cosmetic reno. Extension. The last category of renovation is an actual extension to the property. This includes extending the footprint of the dwelling outward. It also includes extending upwards because for some blocks the only option is to go up, or it may just be the most efficient. Converting a non-habitable area like a detached garage into a habitable area like a bedroom or games room would also be included in this category. Clearly, with this process, you are extending beyond the limits of the existing structure, and so this requires the highest level of building approval, tradespeople and builder involvement and a greater cost. In fact, there is no benchmark on price for an extension because it all depends on the size and the complexity of the works. It might be anywhere from $20,000 for adding a bedroom up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now that we have looked at the different types of renovation, let's cover the specific site characteristics that you need to be aware of when looking for a renovation deal. Search terms. Firstly, let's look at how you might search for a renovation using various search terms. This has already been touched on in a previous module, but using search engines like Investar and realestate.com.au allow you to search by term. These terms might include renovation, renovator's delight, original condition, demolition or tradies welcome. Recognise though that there would also be a lot of properties that would benefit from a renovation that is not necessarily being advertised that way. Another approach is to search by numbers of bedrooms. This is because searching for a low number of bedrooms, for example 2, may give you scope to add another bedroom, and that would immediately lift it into another price point category. Similarly, taking a 3-bedroom dwelling and converting it into a 4-bedroom should increase its value. Searching for multiple living, family or dining rooms can also be beneficial. This is because a formal dining room, a formal lounge, a games room or family room could each be converted into a bedroom, and depending on their size, they could be converted into multiple bedrooms. Garage conversions can do the same, although in this instance you need to confirm that the building complies because a garage is typically built as a non-habitable room and the requirements differ from a habitable room like a bedroom. Ceiling height and the thickness of the slab, assuming it's a slab build, are both key factors to consider. Searching based on the number of bathrooms can also be beneficial, because adding an ensuite to a single bathroom house or unit can often increase its value. What you want to make sure though is that the cost of adding the bathroom is less than the value it creates. For example, paying $6,000 to add an ensuite in order to only increase the value by $6,000 isn't necessarily a good deal from a value perspective. In fact, it would only be worth doing if it meant that the property would sell much more quickly or it substantially increased the rental income and the rental appeal of the property. Condition of the property. The condition of the property clearly has a significant impact on the extent of renovation required. If your strategy is to do a cosmetic renovation, but in fact the property you are considering is in a very poor state of disrepair, then this may not be the right property for your strategy. Similarly, if you intend to do a structural renovation, when really the property is in such poor condition that it is more suited to demolition, then clearly this needs to be identified up front, not when you are halfway through the renovation. The most ideal type of property for a cosmetic renovation is one that is built very solidly, has a good layout, but the fittings and finishes are just dated. Maybe it still has the original finishes from when it was first built 30 years or so ago. Because the bathrooms and kitchen are the most expensive to renovate, a property that just requires a superficial work in these areas will be more suitable for a cosmetic renovation. Alternatively, a property that is more modern but is purely presented and has just been neglected over the years is another good example. If you can get something with poor street appeal, and that's either completely overgrown with vegetation or is completely devoid of vegetation, then creating that wow factor from the street is a great strategy. That's because landscaping, adding a front path, front fence, and creating some interest at the front entry can be very cost effective and completely change the feel and look of a property. The type of property that will suit or require a structural renovation is one that may be older and not originally built with the conveniences of modern living, like an ensuite, for example. That is not to say that a modern house cannot be suited to a structural renovation too, though. Many houses, old and new, have been built with boxy rooms, including a separate room for the kitchen, dining and lounge, and these rooms were often located towards the front of the house. Modern-day living, in contrast, is more aligned with open-plan living and connection between the indoor living areas and the outdoors. These dwellings would suit a structural renovation, where walls are removed or repositioned to open up the kitchen, lounge and dining. These areas may be moved towards the rear of the dwelling, and large doors installed to connect these open living areas to the rear yard areas. Often an outdoor deck or al fresco entertaining area is created. Clearly, the less walls you need to remove and the less movement of water and power services, the more cost-effective will be the structural renovation. It is important to consider the type of construction of the dwelling also. For example, older timber dwellings with painted timber windows, doors, and even timber-cladded internal and external walls can be a higher cost to renovate. This is because the preparation of the timber is much more labour-intensive and time-consuming, particularly if you need to strip back the old paint first before repainting. In contrast, aluminium windows are much less work, as are exterior wall finishes like brick and blockwork, render and bag finish, or concrete walls and weatherboard materials. Timber dwellings that are raised off the ground, whether it's 600 mil or full high-set two-storey height, also tend to experience movement over time. The stumps that they are sitting on can move, particularly in older dwellings. In fact, the condition of the stumps is a very important consideration with this type of dwelling because they do need to be straightened and even replaced from time to time, and this can be a costly process, particularly if you have not budgeted for it. The movement can cause the timber windows and doors to jam and not work smoothly. It can affect the slope of the floor and can cause gaps to form in the floors, walls and ceiling. Each of these are telltale signs to look out for. It is not all bad news with this style of house though. In fact, there are some very significant benefits. The first being that because the house is raised off the ground, the plumbing and electrical services tend to run under the floor, making any work to the wet areas and kitchen an easier task, compared with a slab on ground place where you may need to jackhammer up areas of the slab to access particularly the plumbing. Also, installing extra electrical fittings like power points, lights and TV points can be easier in a raised house because the cabling is more accessible. Having the opportunity to inspect the integrity of the structure from underneath the house in these properties is also very beneficial. By looking up from underneath, you can see the quality and integrity of the floor bearers and joists, the condition of the flooring, and you can see any wet stains that may suggest current or historical moisture damage. The floors in this type of dwelling are also often timber, but then covered over with carpet or vinyl or even tiles. Stripping back these coverings and polishing the timber floors can create an immediate wow factor in this type of home. Keep in mind also that a property with the wet areas and kitchen all in close proximity to each other can be less expensive to renovate and install. This is because the length of plumbing piping between them is less, as is the work to install them, particularly if it involves jackhammering the slab. Bathrooms and kitchens that abut an exterior wall can also be easier to renovate and install because the services, particularly the plumbing, may run out of the wall, therefore making it easier to access. Age of the property. The age of the property is going to give you a very good indication of the extent of renovation work required, and the older the property, the more work that is likely to be needed, particularly if it's still in its original condition. The older it is, the older the services are likely to be, including the plumbing, piping and connections, and the electrical cabling and fittings. Not only are you likely to have to replace the kitchen and bathroom and electrical fittings throughout, but you are also likely to have to upgrade the full electrical wiring and plumbing in the place too, and clearly this all comes at a cost. The materials used are also likely to be less common and less available now, for example stone and mortar, VJ timber panelling, horsehair plastered walls and cornice to name a few. Trying to match these materials or repair them may also be more expensive and may require specialist trades or craftsmen, for example a stonemason. Being aware of this and doing your research upfront is important. A lot of first-time renovators will jump at the dog property as they think a property has to be really bad in order to make money. In reality, the truth is the reverse. In most cases, it is the structurally sound property that is old and dated and poorly presented that offers the most potential for upside. Heritage and demolition control. In addition to the age of the property, another important characteristic when considering a renovation strategy is whether the building is heritage listed or in an area where the streetscape is being preserved by council or is a demolition control area. In all of these examples, council will restrict what you can do to the property through renovation and extension, and it is not necessarily just the front facade that they are interested in. Basically, any works that have the potential to alter the overall look of the building will be assessed, even down to the colour palette you use to repaint. Understanding the requirements relative to the property and area you are looking in is critical. This is because complying with it could quickly blow out your budget and your time frame. Council approval is likely to be required, even if it is a cosmetic renovation, which in any other area would not require council approval. Signs of concern. When looking at properties for potential renovation, you need to be very vigilant to look out for anything unexpected. Things like major cracks in the walls, floors, and even ceilings. This can suggest potential movement in the foundations and structure of the dwelling, and this can be very costly to rectify. This is not always the case though, and it may be rectified through a quick fix. Getting a qualified person like a building or engineer to assess it is therefore highly recommended, as it could turn a profitable cosmetic renovation into a full-blown structural reno that eats up all of your profit. Another sign to look out for is a wet, musty smell in a dwelling. Obviously, this might just be because it's been closed up for a while, but it may also be a sign of something more sinister, like rising damp, where moisture is moving in through the walls or floor. This can be an expensive thing to fix because it's hard to track where water is moving in from. Alternatively, it may be a sign of poor wet ceiling in a bathroom or kitchen, and it could turn a superficial bathroom reno into one that requires the full replacement of the bathroom. Excessive mould is also a telltale sign of moisture issues. Termite damage. Termite damage can be your friend or your foe. Where the damage is fairly minor, limited in extent and superficial, this can be fairly easily fixed. Where the damage is much more extensive and affects the structural integrity of the building, then clearly this can have a significant impact on your renovation budget. Understanding the extent of the damage upfront is critical, because if found too late, it could become a significant issue. Certainly, most people are uneducated about termite damage and how it can be repaired, and therefore they are scared away by it. This creates a potential opportunity for those more educated and prepared to do their research upfront, like you. In fact, you can do a property search on Investar using the keywords termite damage. Asbestos. Asbestos is another one of those terms that can scare people off a property. Educating yourself on what it looks like, where it is often found in a property, how it can be repaired or removed, and the likely costs is important if you are considering renovation as a strategy. Material containing asbestos is widespread in older dwellings because it was used so prevalently in the construction industry, and in fact it was only fully banned for use in building materials in 2003. It can be found in the wall, the ceiling sheeting, bathroom flooring, exterior cladding, sheeting and soffit, roof sheeting, tiles, glues, pipes, cement, and even in fence material. Below are some classic photos of asbestos material. Asbestos needs to be managed by a professional because of its adverse health impacts. Understanding the regulations for handling and working around this material is imperative, and you need to educate yourself before you start working around it. If left in place, undisturbed, it can be inert. However, as soon as it is damaged, drilled into, broken, or even cleaned with a high-pressure hose, this can cause particles to dislodge, become airborne and hazardous to not only you but the neighbours as well, so it is something to be very aware of. The cost to remove it can be very high also, given the process that needs to be followed, and so having this costed early in your budget is imperative, because again, it could turn a profitable deal sour. Grid variance analysis. Having covered a range of the building's specific characteristics to be aware of when undertaking a renovation strategy, we now also need to look at the market-specific characteristics. The most important for renovation is the price variance in the area. Remember from Module 4, we used grid variance analysis to quantify the price variance of areas. We compared the difference in price between properties at the low end of the market compared to the mid of the market in each area. We want to target those areas with the greatest gap between these price ranges and therefore the greatest uplift potential. This is because when you renovate, you want to take the property from the low of the market and sell it at the mid of the market and get the biggest bang for your renovation buck. For example, if you had the choice of the same house in two suburbs, both with the same low entry price of, say, $300,000, but one suburb had a mid price of $400,000, while the other had a mid price of $480,000. Clearly, the latter suburb would give you the greater potential bang for your buck and the greater price uplift potential. Remember, though, that while it is important to have some further upside in the market, you really don't want to position your end product to sell at the high of the market. This is because there are less buyers at that level. And remember that you are always wanting to target the maximum volume in the market to sell into. The cost of your renovation will also play a major factor here, because the more expensive your renovation, the greater the price variance needs to be in the area you propose to do the renovation in. For example, if you are planning to do an extension and your cost is, say, $100,000, then by the time you have purchase costs, hold costs, sale costs, and you make a profit on the deal, you need to be buying it at a low of, say, $500,000 and selling at the mid of the market of, say, $750,000. If you were doing a cosmetic renovation on the same property for 10% of the purchase price at, say, $50,000, then you only need the suburb to have a mid-range price of around $650,000 for you still to make a profit. You can see from this example that if the suburb's mid-price was only $650,000, then you would be overcapitalizing to do an extension on the property, and a cosmetic renovation would probably be the limit for this area. Undermarket value. Undermarket buying is a valuable strategy when doing a renovation. This will not be covered again here as it was discussed in great detail above. Your attention is drawn to it again though, as it can completely change the viability of doing a renovation, particularly if the area has a lower price variance than would normally be required. This is because you have essentially forced a greater variance by buying the property under the market value. You have created your own upside more than what naturally existed in the market. What does the market want? There is a real danger with a renovation strategy when you make decisions based on what you like, how you like to live, and where you would like to live. The danger is that you can become emotionally attached to the process. You make decisions from your personal perspective rather than what the market wants. Unfortunately, this can easily result in overcapitalization, which can turn a potentially profitable deal into a dud. The way to avoid this is to ensure that you have researched what the market wants and allow this to guide your decisions. For example, how many bedrooms do you need to be targeting in the end product? Is a single garage okay, or does it need to be a double garage? Is an ensuite essential and a walk-in robe? Do all bedrooms need built-in robes? Are laminate bench tops acceptable, or do they need to be stone? Where does the market want to be? For example, do they want to be near parks or sporting fields or private schools or near other key infrastructure like public transport, shops, cafe areas? And will they pay a premium for this? Strata titled properties. There are a couple of unique opportunities when renovating a property that is strata titled and under management by a body corporate, like units, townhouses and apartments. The first is the sinking fund. This is a pool of money that every owner in the property is required to pay into annually, and which is to be used for ongoing maintenance of the building and the communal areas. The unique opportunity with this is that some sinking funds are very large, and there may be the opportunity to request through the body corporate that the funds be used to update the exterior of the building, like repaint or render or modernise the hand railing or upgrade the common foyer area or landscaping. Because these works are being paid out of the sinking fund, you will get the benefit from the improvements without having personally contributed to the fund, especially if you have just recently bought the property. So while you are renovating the inside of your property, the body corporate could be renovating the outside. Clearly, this could have an enormous impact on the end value of the property. To investigate these works, you may have to take a lead role in raising the idea at the body corporate meeting, getting the other owners on side and arranging quotes, etc. But it could definitely be worth your while. Alternatively, you may target a property that is in a complex that is already in the process of renovation by the body corporate or proposed in the near future. The other unique property opportunity with some strata title properties is if you own one of the top floor units or apartments and you are able to negotiate to gain access and usage rights to the rooftop space. This has happened before when the owners were able to add a complete rooftop level to their apartment with private spiral stair access. This area was assigned to them as long as they paid for the works to wet seal the roof and install the necessary safety measures, etc. In this instance, the rooftop area gave them spectacular ocean views and added significant value to their apartment. Income strategies. Income strategies are those strategies where a positive cash flow property is the end result. Hence, the income from the property exceeds the expenses, including interest on 100% of the purchase price, plus any costs associated with the property. These properties are otherwise referred to as a cash cow property. They are either a direct cash cow, where the property is positive from the day you buy it, or an indirect cash cow, where you have to do something to the property in order to turn it into a positive cash flow. So let's now drill down to the property characteristics you are looking for across the range of income strategies. Executive leasing. Executive leasing is where a property is leased short or long term to an executive tenant, either as an individual person or a company tenant for its staff. Typically, the property is in a high demand area and more often in a metro area, but not always. The key to this strategy is understanding what the market wants. And so in terms of executive leasing, it's researching the property managers that specialise in this area and determining from them what they want from an executive rental, what location, down to the street, even the building, and what part of the building, such as the aspect, view or access, can play a significant part. What facilities need to be available in the general area, for example, transport, access to shopping and restaurants and entertainment, etc. What facilities need to be available in the building, for example, heated swimming pool, gymnasium, cafe or restaurant. Then down to the actual apartment or house, what needs to be provided, for example, fully furnished, cleaning and linen service, yard maintenance, to name a few. What quality of finishes are required? For example, fully renovated high-end finishes, or is mid-range acceptable? The difference being stone benches or laminate tops, walk-through hobless shower, or a 900 by 900 shower-based shower. Timber Venetian blind or full blockout double roller blinds. This is the level of detail you need to get down to. Once you know exactly what the tenants and therefore the property managers require, then you go out and find that product or create that product if it doesn't already exist. Remember that you are creating a product for a particular end user, not for yourself, and so you need to be directed by what that end user requires. Short stay accommodation, for example, Airbnb. This strategy is where you rent a part of your property typically to a traveller, generally on a short-term basis. The property may be your PPR or an investment property that you have set up specifically for this purpose. The essential aspect of this strategy is that the property is in a location where people want to stay. Unlike executive leasing that tends to be more metro, short stay accommodation can literally be anywhere, as long as there are a reason for being there. So even unique or quirky locations could work, as long as there is a demand. Just remember though that the more unique or quirky the location or property, potentially the smaller the population that it will appeal to, which may not be what you want when you are trying to run a business, which is what this is. You want broad appeal. Again, understanding your target market will dictate the specific characteristics of the property you are targeting. Also keep in mind that you may ultimately want to sell the property, and so being mindful of this and its location and the population size for selling into is important. Depending on the number of bedrooms you intend to rent out and whether you are living there or not, you should also make inquiries with council regarding the maximum number of people that can reside in a standard dwelling house, particularly unrelated people, as this does make a difference. They are unrelated people because, in effect, you could have each room rented to different people that have never previously met and yet are sharing the same space for the duration of the stay. The overriding consideration is people's safety and ensuring that you comply with the council and building code requirements in this regard. Boarding house and student accommodation. These rent-by-room style accommodation types are purpose-specific and need to comply with the various regulatory bodies in the area. Council approval may be required from a town planning perspective, including zoning, particularly if you are developing it from scratch. Even if you are renovating an existing building, though, depending on the number of bedrooms and the purpose of use, the zoning may still be very relevant. Council's Occupational Health and Safety Department may also require approval for this use, depending on the council's requirements and the nature of the business being operated. Similarly, the Building Code of Australia needs to be complied with because there are different classes of building depending on the number of bedrooms and the overall size of the building. The code dictates such things as fire management requirements, for example, smoke alarms, exit signage, disability access, and facility requirements, to name a few. On top of this, the tenancy authority in your state will also have regulations, as does the Office of Fair Trading, regarding the operating of this style of accommodation. Hopefully, from this brief explanation, you can see that understanding the various local government and authority requirements in your specific location is essential in order to inform your decision on the specific characteristics that you are looking for in a property. The next step is to overlay the specific needs of the end users and understand what it is they require, as this will impact on the characteristics you are looking for or indeed need to create. For example, are shared bathroom facilities acceptable or do they need to be en suites? Does it need to be fully or partially furnished? What amount of lockable storage is required in the kitchen? Is car parking required? This is just to name a few. Location will also be dictated by the end user. For example, if you are providing student accommodation, clearly the property needs to be in close proximity to an education facility, university, TAFE, college, etc. Being close to public transport, shops and facilities also tends to be important for this strategy. Granny flat and dual occupancy. This strategy is about converting existing dwellings or parts of dwellings into granny flats or dual occupancy, or alternatively constructing them from scratch with the intention of creating multiple income stream properties. Either way, the dwellings need to comply with the council requirements for that usage, in which case zoning, land size, site cover, and all of the factors discussed above under development approval are potentially relevant. Depending on your council, however, you may find that in fact no prior council approval is required, as long as you comply with certain criteria. In this case, it is more likely to be a building certifier that can sign off on the project and ensure that work is also compliant with the Building Code of Australia. The draftsperson that prepares your design plans should also have a good working knowledge of the requirements, and consulting with them in advance is invaluable, along with the town planner. That way you know what it is you are looking for before you begin the search. A granny flat can be added as a secondary dwelling. This might be a separate garage conversion, a new construction, or even a prefab. With this option, issues to consider would include separate access parking, lot size, and of course, cost comparative to rental yield. Another option is to have an extension to the existing house to accommodate an extra dwelling or rental. This can often save slightly on cost, however, doesn't have the separation for sound and privacy that the first option may have. The third option is my favourite, as it is usually the most cost-effective, and that is to reconfigure the internals of the existing house to accommodate an extra dwelling. Again, it may mean privacy is slightly compromised. However, if done well, the reconfigure will have a separate external entrance, parking, and even yard separation through clever fencing. Just as an exercise, look up some project builders' plans and see how you might reconfigure their standard plans to accommodate a secondary dwelling. Storage sheds. Storage sheds are a commercial multiple income stream cash cow strategy. They can be anything from a row of garage-style units through to multi-level buildings. Because they are a specialist land use, they must be located in the correct zoning for that council, which is typically industrial zoning. Council will also have a raft of town planning requirements that need to be adhered to, including land size, site cover, setbacks, car parking, driveway access, to name a few, and consulting with a town planner will reveal this information. The Building Code of Australia also has design requirements that will need to be complied with, which a draftsperson and building certifier will be able to advise on. If you are purchasing a pre-existing facility, you still want to confirm that it is council approved and compliant. The location of the facility is also relevant. High exposure sites are more highly desirable. Also, being located near residential areas and more affluent residential areas is better, as they have a higher disposable income to spend on storage and more things to store. Remember that it is not just the storage sheds themselves that you can rent, but also the hard stand areas surrounding, particularly for boats, jet skis, caravans, cars and the like. Research on the competition in the area is also vital, because this is a business that you are operating, not just owning the real estate. Unless, of course, you lease out the site and someone else takes on the full management. In any case, the success of the lessee still impacts on you dramatically, as you want them to be able to continue to pay the rent. This type of research is similar to the grid variance analysis described in Module 3. In this instance, however, you are gridding on a map all of the other storage sheds providers in that town, or within, say, 50 kilometres of you. For each provider, you want to know the range of facilities that they offer for rent, their rental rates, occupancy rate, if they have a waiting list and for what. Do they have capacity? Who manages the facility? How long have they been in business? Do they plan to retire or sell anytime soon? And what volume of traffic passes the facility? Also, information on the demographics of the surrounding area, the catchment population size, the average family income, and the median house value needs to be gathered. All of this information is vital to understand who your competitors are, what the strengths and weaknesses of their business are, and where you fit into the mix. This research method should also be employed if you are considering establishing a storage shed facility from scratch. Having gridded the location of all of the facilities on a map and knowing the demographics of the area they service, you will then be able to identify on the map potential gaps that are not yet serviced by a storage facility. Researching the main feeder roads into that area and the area demographics will highlight if the area has potential. It is also valuable to be aware that there is a storage shed industry association that is a wealth of information. There are also specialist consultants that can do the research, design, and even advise on the management aspects, but obviously this all comes at a cost. There are also larger franchise holders such as Storage King that will work with purchasers to identify potential sites, coordinate design, approvals, construction and management, although you need to have at least around $1 million to attract this type of partner. Strip shops. When talking about strip shops here, it means existing shops that are shops in a row along a street and may be freestanding or under the same building roofline. You may be buying multiple shops or potentially splitting the lettable area into multiple lettable areas for multi-income streams. These shops may be anything from retail shops to hairdressers to cafes and the like. When you are researching this type of deal, it is essential that you research the area to ensure that the location will remain relevant over the long term, or at least over the period you intend to own it for. For example, if the town centre moves owing to the opening of a new shopping complex and the strip shopping area you are located in becomes less visited and hence a less desirable location to operate a business, then this will obviously impact on your capacity to attract a quality tenant, not only impacting on your cash flow, but also your capital value. Once you are happy with the area, it's then important to confirm that the building is approved for that usage, that the necessary building approvals and operating approvals are in place, and then research the existing tenants, their lease, and the nature of their business. Clearly, the more successful the tenant's business is, the more secure will be your income stream. Hostel, backpacker, motel, caravan park. Hostel, backpacker, motel and caravan parks are all specialist commercial properties. A word of advice when researching these types of deals is to research other similar properties on the market and develop a profile of what makes a good caravan park or motel or hostel business. What are the typical operating costs, the income range, the factors that affect these parameters, and therefore the industry standards, from which you can then compare your properties of interest. Researching the competitors in the market is also important, and the method to do this is the same as I described above for storage sheds. As with storage sheds, there are industry bodies, specialist brokers, accountants, and consultants that will be able to guide you in your research on these styles of properties, and you would be sensible to leverage off them. General commercial and industrial. The types of properties that fall under general commercial and industrial include things like offices and industrial sheds. The property-specific characteristics that you need to look for are the same as those described above for the other more specialist commercial properties, including understanding the location, the permanency of the location, and its relevance in the area, the competition, the strength of any existing tenants and leases, and the existence of the necessary approvals to operate in that location. Commercial brokers are invaluable when doing this research, as a good broker will have their finger on the pulse regarding what's happening in the area. As a first deal, buying an existing commercial deal that already has a tenant and leases in place may be right for you if you have had business experience yourself, or if it will form part of a bigger diversified portfolio. Commercial can be a strong investment because of the nature and strength of the income. However, all commercial does come with a higher level of risk and as such requires a greater level of due diligence. An in-depth analysis on the characteristics and due diligence of commercial property is beyond the scope of this manual, as an entire manual just on commercial property could be written. Higher yield properties in resource and mining areas. In high yielding resource and mining areas, researching the property's specific characteristics relevant to your strategy is essential, and everything that has been covered in the section above is relevant. What is as important, or even more important in these areas though, is to research and understand the drivers of the market in that area, not only the industries involved, but also down to the major companies. Clearly the success of the companies in the area and the commodities they are producing will significantly affect the population of the town, and thus the tenants that you require for your rentals. Important information to be researched here is the stage at which the project sits. Is it in construction or operation, or nearing the end of the mine life? Clearly, each of these stages will affect the workforce required, and therefore the demand for accommodation. Understanding any new project is also important. What stage in the process are they at, and what may affect their progress? With this type of strategy, this research needs to be ongoing, so it is not a set and forget process, because as the market, commodities and industries change, you need to be abreast of this too. Also, you need to understand the property market in the area and keep a watch of new residential projects that may bring a quantity of new properties on the market. This is because these will become your competitors from a tenanting perspective, and so being on top of this information is important if you want to maintain and maximise your yields. From the types and styles of income strategies, select a strategy that you are more likely to do or incorporate into your first few deals and write a list of the characteristics you need to look for in a deal of this type. The more deals you can add and the more specific you can be at this stage, the easier it will be for you to find the deal you are after when the time comes. Here are some interesting stats to finish this module from the Australian Bureau of Statistics.